Tune in to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM, and be part of an in-depth discussion on events you didn't know you needed to hear until you do, from Namibia, Africa, and around the world. Tune in from Monday to Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. only on Eagle FM.
Good afternoon, Namibians, wherever you find yourself. Thank you for tuning into Eagle FM, and this is Home Run with Helmut and Dwight. As always, we're here until the hour of 6, and today, let's talk about housing. Dwight, here's my definition of homelessness. I believe...
Okay, go for it.
Look, my definition of homeless is much more technical, and the conclusion I've reached with regards to homeless is that homelessness is that a lot of us, okay, there are more homeless people in the world than we actually count. If you ask me, in my definition of homelessness, I live with my uncle. My uncle has a big house, homeless. You don't have, that's your uncle's house. I live in this beautiful flat somewhere here in town, homeless. First of all, you don't own the property. So I feel like, unless you own the property, you're homeless. Now, by my definition is so brutal that even I, myself, the inventor of the definition, is homeless. So, let's talk about, we're not here to talk about my technical definition of the word homeless. We're here to talk about Africa, the whole continent, and its take on urbanization and equitable housing. Let's go with affordable housing. Every time that we talk about any type of development, be it energy, health, education, it's always important to throw in, to add in the word, to use the word affordable. Because houses are there. We have houses.
Yeah.
The question is, are they affordable? No. And that discussion spills into food insecurity. There is food in pretty much every grocery store across the country.
Yeah,
it's the accessibility. It's the means of accessibility that's the problem, not the produce.
Yeah.
So, now, the African Union last week, right?
It happened last week.
Yeah, they met in Nairobi, Kenya. I was this close to saying Addis Ababa, Kenya. They met in Nairobi, Kenya. Now, this is the African, the African Union, the African Union, of course. They met for the second Africa Urban Forum, which was established in Egypt back in 2022 or 2021. Yeah, 2022 in Cairo, Egypt. According to the African Union's description of the body, which was also described more like described in the video that you shared, the African Union specialized technical committee on public service, local government, urban development, and decentralization. That's a very long abbreviation, but anyway, on its fourth ordinary session held on 31 August 2022 in Cairo, Egypt decided to establish the Africa Urban Forum as a dedicated continental platform for advancing Africa's urban agenda.
But now I ask you, Hamad.
Of course.
I ask you now. Okay, I don't have denim blue eyes, so I need to leave that out. That punchline is no longer valid.
Okay.
But I ask you now. We sit with known issues in Namibia, and Africa also knows that it has the same issues across the continent itself. Mm-hmm. The unknowns that popped up in this second forum was I did not know that Namibia was also a member to Shelter Afrique Development Bank. So this is a development bank older than the African Development Bank. That tries to focus on housing and urbanization development infrastructure installations. So we're talking about anything to do with urbanization. This entity, this supranational entity for the continent is there. But that it actually has been in existence since 1946? It's older than the OAU, Helmut?
Yep.
And it's been based in Nairobi ever since. Now, here's another thing that also pops up. I don't know. We joked just before the show started about how you and I, we constantly get new shocks every day. Every time when we walk in here for the studio, we've been shocked by what we had to observe, read, and we then deduced that how come we didn't know about certain entities that have, that play a pivotal role or can play a critical role in achieving certain particular goals? How come we didn't know about these things?
That's the first thing you found shocking in that whole thing?
Yeah, about the Shelter Africa, the Tierno Habib Han, who showed up there and said, thank you, where he thanked the speaker and the Kenyan President Ruto about for being housed in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, for the past almost 80, almost 100 years. So this organization is older than the OAU, with its French name and all that. It's an older development bank. And we've been struggling for, that's not all of Africa, with almost 100 years of urbanization issues. Now, here comes the other critical sort of like punchline discussion. So then, the next guy that speaks steps up, the guy from Azerbaijan.
Now, that is the part that I found shocking.
What's the guy's name? Kuniev, something.
As like Azerbaijan?
Yeah. So Azerbaijan walks up to the stage. Here's what knocks me out, which I know has happened in Azerbaijan.
Mm-hmm.
They immediately realized, Hamut, that there is, you know, countries with developmental issues will always have a rapid rural to urbanization migration problem, i.e. the urban centers have to identify what industries are going to happen there. They've got to come up with their templates, with their proposals, with their issues, with their they've got to do their own SWOT analyses, not the weird SWOT analysis that you and I did the other time of the Ministry of Health's digital health policy document, where it went weakness, but strength, opportunity.
Yeah.
Now, if you just have strength, opportunity, now what is the threat? What threat is there?
Well, just throw that in the bucket of weakness.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But take that whole digital policy document, Helmut. That Ministry of Health digital policy document.
Mm-hmm.
That policy document has to literally plug in, like you're taking a USB external flash drive and you're plugging it into a computer, because a USB flash drive allows you to copy on any file, any document, any other particular element in a digital format, carry it on you because it's a flash drive, and you go plug it in somewhere else. No puns intended, guys. I'm not highlighting any other particular...
Too late.
It's still, Helmut. I'm not there. I'm showing you what the technology was meant for. Now, that's how, for example, Namibia's public health sector has to function. So it has to be adaptable. It has to be fluid. It has to think quick on its feet as urban centers of the country are growing, expanding, going through what they call those particular population trends, meaning you will sometimes have young people moving out of the towns, just leaving the elderly and the slightly older working populations there. For example, let me give you an ugly example, Helmut, that's going on in Italy, and I will literally cross-reference it to Namibia.
Yeah.
Many of Italy's, and this is also Europe, in greater Europe, the other Western European countries, many of Italy's bigger issues are that, and this happens also in Japan, where I explained to you the schools closing down in the rural areas.
Yeah.
So the young people, the moment they finish high school, they move immediately out of the small towns in Italy. So now the small towns are dying out because it only means that the elderly and the slightly older economically productive people are left in the town. But the schools are closing. When the schools close, there are no new young people taking up these school spots and the likes and so on and so forth. You will reach a scenario also in Namibia where I know for sure we have this issue, but it's happening all across the country, meaning the rural areas are seeing greater migrationary trends. We've got an ad break coming up right now.
okuhinga wa aliko hiyodungo, peha joku hinga uliko hiyodungo. Ogora okuhinga ondapo jiyuthwa, peha joku hinga ondapo ya pitirira. Ogora okutaguru kila po mataguru kilo, peha joku pita owarasha mpoka. Ogora ishewe okurundula omataira we, peha juu kukutu. Ogora okuninga shukasho mojiramo opateletu, eto kupita omwenyo.
This message was brought to you by the National Road Safety Council.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that does not have a capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. 16 past 4, you were saying?
Yeah, so currently Namibia still has some linkages back to its rural communities across the country, but we will reach that threshold, Helmut, where rural villages, rural communities will die out. And I say they die out because the young population moves to the urban centers. The urban centers will have the jobs. They will have the new developmental trends. They will have the industries. They will provide the services that the rural communities do not provide for. And even when you and I had the lofty discussion about what to do to address rapid rural to urban migration, where we, in our own particular lofty analysis, I say lofty because it hasn't happened in 36 years so far, meaning go and invest in the rural communities, that being the regional authorities, have to go and invest in the rural communities so that the rural communities don't suffer rural to urban migration trends. But do you think that is happening? So far, right now, we're still sitting with a centralization issue with regarding resource mobilization, responding to crises, responding to disaster risk management across the country. Everything is still highly centralized, and thus there are limitations immediately imposed on that particular, and I use the term loosely, lofty position or lofty position that we took. Now, Italy is already there. They've already seen rapid rural to urban migrations. And this is from rural villages, which are urban settlements, to larger urban settlements. Japan is already there, meaning rapid rural to urban migration from established, well-invested, well-developed rural communities that they are losing schools. Schools are closing down in Japan,
yep,
in the rural communities. But the schools in the large urban centers are thriving. They are getting, they are allocating more resources to deal with more demand. And that's just on the education landscape, guys. We are also seeing the same thing pressuring us in the education landscape of Namibia, because there is rural to urban, and our colleague, Anakleta Aikera, based in Rundu, sometimes, she's got a nickname, guys. Apparently, we did not know. I did not know that our colleague has been dubbed the mayor of Rundu. I did not know this. We do know that there's an actual mayor, but it's apparently that she's so in touch. But yeah. So, Anakleta has highlighted to us in our own discussion, Helmut, you've been dethroned as our resident, Rundu representative here in Windhoek.
Well, at least I won't go to jail for plotting a coup, a regional coup.
Is that not Anakleta?
I didn't mention any names.
But anyway, yeah. So we're already seeing the pressures happening in Namibia. It's just a ticking time bomb. And then, the authorities that are, that's Ministry of Health, Ministry of Education, Ministry of Home Affairs, Immigration, Safety and Security, they will have to, and MURD, Minister Sankwasa's ministry, they will have to respond a lot quicker, and there will be greater burdens being placed on them to allocate more resources for installation of services in expanding urban scenarios. So that means Rundu, that means Nkurunkuru. Remember the governor of Kavango West, Verna Sinimbo, she highlighted specifically that there is a great demand for Kavango West to have more urban settlements, where I identified literally, listen, you can't have 10,000 people in one town, and 10,000 people have to respond to the needs of 120,000 people in the whole region. It's impossible. It'll put a burden on Nkurunkuru. The same too for Opuo in Kunene. But Kunene, at least, has Opuo, Ochu, and Korejas. And just outlining those particular needs, those particular factors, this is based upon how do you address some of the other clearly obvious deficiencies, which will be housing, construction associated to the housing, and doing this quicker to respond quicker to needs. So just to put that in a nutshell, that is the situation. It is based upon building things, but it is based upon people moving. And I'll leave it there for now, Helmut. On an African perspective, but from a Namibian perspective.
Now, when it comes to the discussion of urban and rural development, it's a good place to start from when you are looking at housing, because the trend of rural to urban migration is not something, like you just pointed out, it's not something that's just unique to Namibia.
Yeah.
This is something that's being observed the world over. Now, in last year's report of the United Nations, where they looked at world urbanization prospects 2025. Now, this is a summary of the result, and that summary is 124 pages long. Now this is something that that's being observed the world over. Now, if that document is in your inbox by now, it should be there. Just on page 5, they do provide somewhat of a summary of the global trends in terms of rural to urban migration going back to the 1950s. Now, the urban transformation, a global shift in how we live, variation in the degree of urbanization globally. Now, we have a food discussion to talk about here when it comes to rural to urban migration, because technology is going to advance, but it's not going to advance, at least not anytime soon, to the point where we can toss aside agriculture and start producing, you know, food out of thin air.
Mm.
Agriculture is going to be a significant part of our species for a very long time, maybe until we get to the point where science can now do the,
Let me put a bookmark in there with agriculture.
Yeah.
According to the economist Steve Keen, the world only has 3 months. If these guys don't sign a peace deal, then we will have a global famine. India will have a famine because it's reliant on the fertilizer from Hormuz.
Yeah.
North Africa. And there's another country. So, yeah, we will run out of food in the next 3 months.
Okay, look, one thing I have learned from the genius of the most brilliant man on this planet, that is Donald Trump, is there are very easy ways to open the strait of Hormuz. Now, if you want to open a strait, step one, find a strait that's already open and then start a war with the guy that controls the strait. When they close it, on top of them closing the strait, get your army to provide a further closure of the strait. That's how we open it. Like, the ridiculousness is just...
Yes.
And that... now, look. That's not the most scary thing right now every time that I look at the White House. You have to understand, that's the guy that is in charge of a country that has nuclear weapons.
Oh, no. And then... he sends his vice president, who has been AWOL for like 2 months. No one knew where J.D. Vance went. And then when Vance showed up to negotiate, because I assumed, Helmut, they weren't talking to each other directly. They were talking through the Pakistanis and the UAE people.
Mm-hmm.
That's how the negotiations were working. You know, you had runners happening between sides.
Yeah.
And it seems like, the Americans were treating this like it's non-negotiable things that they didn't want. But the concern is the phase we are still at, and this is the phase that will even make that claim that I made a little bit earlier
mm-hmm.
even worse. The phase that there's still that 10,000 or something soldiers mm-hmm. that have been accumulating close to the Middle East.
No, look, when it comes to the whole negotiations, the reason why they won't work out is it doesn't look like, at least from a political, from a practical standpoint, it doesn't look like the U.S. or Israel wants to negotiate. Because, you know, in theory, they keep saying that, but in practice, they don't look like they want to negotiate. Because, first of all, if you want to negotiate, why are you sending in a bunch of armed guys?
Yeah,
that's the first thing, because there's a very a stark contrast between what you are saying and what you are doing. So you want to negotiate, you want to bring the whole thing to an end, but your actions is showing the complete opposite of what you are saying.
Mm.
You are talking about a reduction, but your practice is indicating more escalation, and that's one. The second thing is, do I just look at who they sent to negotiate?
Yeah, they sent a glorified property developer and his father or his buddy. The father's buddy.
I think this is his in-law somewhere in
because,
that mix.
Because they were there.
This is the reason why the war started in the first place. When they, who was brokering, was it the Swiss or the Austrians that was brokering the deal before the bomb started exploding?
Switzerland.
It was Switzerland.
They were in Geneva.
Yeah. The US sent the same, real estate developers to go and negotiate with seasoned diplomats with PhDs.
Yeah.
Come on.
With expertise.
They have years of experience.
They had nuclear scientists, join them.
Yeah.
And obviously legal professionals on their side.
These guys have been in this line of work for years.
Yeah. So when the discussion pops up, now, have you heard of the other theory that popped up?
What's that?
The other theory that the son-in-law of Donald Trump, the glorified real estate developer, is the reason as to why the attack happened, why the Israelis attacked. It wasn't the Americans that attacked.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Israelis that shot the first bomb.
Yeah, it was the Israelis because, yeah. Well,
and then
Netanyahu have been singing about going to war with Iran for the past like a million years.
Yeah, and the concern was obviously that, which everyone knows in the Western world's media, is that the son-in-law of Donald Trump has been a family friend of Netanyahu. Because Netanyahu, yeah. When he visits Washington, he doesn't stay over in a hotel under protection. He sleeps over in the Kushner house.
Of course.
Okay, so that's template number one. Template number two, Helmut, is what actually happened in the meeting. So it has come out, apparently, because there have been rumors about someone called the Americans and said the Iranians are not willing, they're not willing to budge on certain points during those negotiations.
Uh-huh.
But when the Omani official, you remember the very famous interview of the guy that was interviewed by Al Jazeera, showed up on TV and he said, no, we are seeing good headwind. We are seeing good concessions being made.
And then,
and the parties are this close to agreeing on finalities and on final thing texts. And what should then look like a substantive agreement. And then the bomb started falling. And that statement came the Wednesday, the Saturday morning, you and I are waking up with democracy supposedly being delivered. The concerns from that was how much the intelligence community alongside the international relations observers, which are journalists of international relations and the likes, everyone kept asking, now what happened in the deal for the Israelis to bomb? And the theory currently right now is that Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner,
mm-hmm.
is the supposed leak of intelligence in terms of he's probably the person who made a phone call saying, yeah, it doesn't seem like things are happening. Go ahead and bomb.
So
this all began.
Okay. So let me just, fly me on a plane here. These guys were negotiating on behalf of the U.S.
Yes. So you and I are sitting in the meeting.
Yeah, we're negotiating on behalf of the U.S.
Yeah.
And then I make the call to the White House that the negotiations are not going as
But you are telling me, uh-huh. I'm the Iranian. No, everything is fine, Dwight. Yeah,
I'm telling you everything is fine.
Yeah, we can negotiate on things. And then there's a third party who's the Omani or the other GCC, uh-huh. the Arab League guys,
yeah.
are here as observers and witnesses to the negotiations. And they are also feeling positive of things. But when you say, I'm quickly going for a toilet break, you make a phone call.
So I make a phone call to the White House.
Yeah.
Now, where does the Israeli bombing comes in here? Because
the other theory is that he first probably called his uncle.
Was he negotiating on behalf of Israel or the U.S.?
He was doing that on behalf of the U.S.
Now, this is the thing. I'm just gonna go with people like Mir Shimer's conclusion here. The Israeli lobbies in the U.S. is so powerful. At this point, it's very easy to reach a conclusion that they basically ran the White House.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now that's the only conclusion that will make sense why someone would negotiate on behalf of the U.S. And when the negotiation fails, it will make sense if the U.S. fired the bomb.
Mm.
But then the bombs are now coming out of Israel.
Mm.
And you are like, okay. Who are you negotiating on behalf of?
Mm.
I mean, that's sort of like the confusion that I found in the negotiation between the U.S. DRC, the U.S. and DRC in Washington. Okay. None of them seems to, to agree that they are supporting the, M23. But then they are in Washington negotiating a peace deal to bring about the war that M23 has been in the middle of, yeah. have been basically the main character.
Yeah.
But there is no M23 representative in the negotiations.
Yeah.
What clearly happened? One of you
is not being honest.
Is not being honest.
Yeah. Or someone
one is, of you is low-key representing M23.
Or someone is not acting in good faith.
Yep.
Now, that has also been the bad observations. It's not bad. It's not that it's been observed badly. It's just the observations also take in consideration not so good or bad elements participating in this equation that you also highlighted out. Now, we're talking here about urbanization, urban development, and all that. However, Helmut, if the global food economy only has 3 months to survive, then urbanization is a nightmare.
One thing I like about that whole, whole analysis?
Yeah.
It's really nice.
No, it is.
It's very nice because one thing I've seen is that Iran has been under sanctions for a very long time, and yeah. Cuba has been under sanction blockade. You name it, the Cubans have been through it. Now they've survived, so that means for a lot of countries that have been reliant on the quote-unquote global market and its interconnectedness. You also have to understand what type of a global world in terms of diplomacy and trade relations is going to come out after this whole nonsense is basically is basically over.
Mm.
Because they would obviously have to think twice to start coming up with more of a shock absorbers in a sense that. You separate some aspects of diplomatic relations and trade relations in a way that when someone starts chaos in the White House, someone in not everyone the world over is affected.
Yeah.
I think this is something we should have thought of before interconnecting everything.
But that was
unintended consequences.
But that's impossible, Albert, because where does globalization come from?
There you go.
Globalization, which is the bigger concern here, which is the thing, the particular project under attack in this whole discussion, is that globalization's issue, Helmut, was that globalization was elevated to the level of the UN. The UN gets this supranational important level, which it has and still has and still maintains,
yeah.
To help steer global agendas. Because the UN can take a neutral position. The UN cannot be biased against one country for another. Which has been an odd concern and an odd statement that Donald Trump himself made last year when he came into the White House. He said they want a divorce from the UN, but yet they keep the UN Security Council status.
Uh, The biggest problem in the world of legislation is like one of the frequently asked philosophical question is, can you have any law without means of enforcement?
Yeah.
That is the serious, that's the giant question mark on international organizations like the UN right now.
Or Namibia.
The UN, when it comes to its legislations, the UN Charter is an impeccable piece of legislative literature. The problem is, how do you enforce it?
Mm. Do you have a police?
Do you have a police?
Do you use an army? Do you use an agency? What do you do?
Yeah, because the idea was we're going to rely on member states to provide the policing aspect of the legislation of the organization. From a very early days, one question that arose was, which member states, all of them, maybe they will have to contribute this annual contribution, and we did talk about this, depending on the size of the economy, mm-hmm. that's also the, you know, that will determine how much they will contribute to the organization annually. Not only do not all of them contribute, but the biggest contributors are also the biggest misbehaviors.
Mm-hmm.
How do you hold them accountable? That brings us to the example of our childhood example of that kid that came with a ball.
Mm.
Yeah. If his team loses, the match is over.
And he's the ref.
And he's the manager. He's the coach.
He's the decider of how long the match is. And everybody's at his mercy.
It's impossible to hold someone that's basically funding your day-to-day operations accountable.
Yeah.
Because if they leave, you are left with, no operations. So that's a very tight situation that international organizations, especially the UN, finds itself right now. Because some of the biggest contributors to the UN, both budgets, they have a peacekeeping budget and they have a general one, with one that's most predominantly used for operations.
Mm.
The biggest contributor has always been Western countries, especially the US.
And then
now you can see now when it comes to the UN, the US is this kid that comes to the playground with a ball. You can't make them angry, otherwise they're gonna leave and the match will be over.
Mm. Oh, there was no match even.
There'll be no match.
Yeah. Now,
how do you discipline that kid?
We
have all been in that situation. You just follow. If they say, you take off your shirts, and before you take off your shoes, you're gonna take off your shoes.
Yep.
Or you're not gonna play.
We're gonna be shirts against the shirtless, and then.
Yeah, and you the shirtless
guys are like, but we were shirtless yesterday. Why can't you be shirtless today?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, listen, whose ball is it?
Exactly.
And then the argument ends right there.
You're just gonna.
The argument ends right there.
Now, urban and rural development. The UN 2025 World Urbanization Prospects, page 5, says the following. Today more people live in cities than either in towns or in rural areas. But that has not always been the case, according to the report. At the middle of the 20th century, city living was relatively unusual. Close to 500 million people lived in cities in 1950, equivalent to just one-fifth of the world's 2.5 billion total population. That's the fifth of the 2.5 billion worldwide population in the 1950s. Those lived in cities.
Yeah.
Now, the remaining four-fifths were evenly split between towns and rural areas. Now, in the decades that followed, the number of people living in cities and towns grew rapidly, while the rural population increased only slowly. By mid 1970s, by mid 1970s, city dwellers outnumbered those in a rural area. So, by 1950s, the rural to urban population was somewhat split. It was almost half and half. But you can already see the direction the pendulum was swinging in, and that's the growth of the shrinking of rural areas and the growth of towns and cities.
Yeah. Yeah. Which looks like Namibia.
Yep.
Just what you're explaining right there.
Yep. Because if you look at our 2011 statistics, the population was more leaning towards rural.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, but right now we're almost 50-50, and it's very easy to see the direction, the direction the population growth is headed. By the next statistics, if we just take the same gap that we took between 2011 and 2023, the population, the rural population is going to be really, 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 really low compared to the urban one.
Yep.
That means housing. And also, here's the thing. We're talking about infrastructure expansion into the whole country. And that means also you're talking about providing, hospitals and clinics and schools and internet connection, the digital connectivity all across the country. That includes rural areas.
Mm.
Now, if there is a very visible trend right now that is indicating how rural areas are shrinking, we're going to be left with, we're going to find ourselves in a Japanese institution, in a Japanese situation where you have schools that are now closing down.
Yeah.
Because, well, all the opportunities are away in urban areas.
And it's not just that, it's that the rural settlements and villages, they stagnate, Hamid. The example given from that discussion where the journalist had the slight extended piece on Japanese rural schools was a scenario where the journalist couldn't look past the education system. Even though they started off with a very strong statistic in terms of highlighting that the example was that a girl who graduated from her school.
Mm-hmm. One.
She was the only student in grade 12. All her teachers sat in the class and clapped hands for her because that was their last day of also being employed at that school for the teachers.
Yeah, it does also feed into employment discussion. Yeah.
So, and those are the nuances that that we have to factor in, for example, in a Namibian/African context, because like you highlighted there, those Western developed countries, Namibia had the same trajectory and the same trends. They firstly were predominantly rural with the first industrial revolution. What happened was they had all these rural people, these people in the rural areas,
mm-hmm.
very small cities. The cities were not industrious. They didn't have much industries. And boom, when the steam engine for the first locomotive happened and the various developments in agro-processing popped up, modernization happened. Then you started seeing many people realizing, but there are more opportunities to make money in the urban settlements. Let's move. We can't just be growing potatoes every day.
Yeah.
Now, you're going to see the same thing happen in Namibia. Namibia will sit with the same issues. And even Sankwasa, obviously, trying to keep in line. I'm sorry that I'm name dropping the minister, but the minister, remember from his council, his councillors swearing in processes in last month, the two events that he had, the one in Rundu, there was another one apparently here in the south of Namibia. He did the exact same thing. Even though he gave stern words there to those councillors of the regional and local authorities, at the heart of it is, Hamid, if these councillors don't, if they don't see the big picture, because the big picture in economic planning is you must see and anticipate issues, which is also the issue that we did not see with the Ministry of Health's policy document, the digital health policy. We didn't see the big picture. The big picture didn't talk about building or installing more clinics with officials positioned there, because what happens now, Helmut, if the uranium exploration activity here in the east of Namibia kicks off? Now Leonardville becomes not just a village anymore. Now it progresses and grows into an actual town.
Ooh.
Now Leonardville needs more services, needs more this, needs more that, and they will need more this and more that, storage facilities, the likes. What happens then? Now we're going to hear about, by 2030, oh my goodness, the Ministry of Health has to respond to putting a hospital there because the actual hospital in Khobabas is not adequately staffed, is not adequately upgraded or up to date with equipment and infrastructure.
Yeah.
And now we need to put more money. So then the whole discussion, even of trying to force the whole public sector to use just the public health facility, becomes a failed experiment, because in order for you to respond to health crises, you must firstly have the infrastructure and the resources there. Okay, that's scenario number one. Scenario number two, what then happens with if the green hydrogen project, literally the main one in Lüderitz, starts kicking off?
Yeah.
There's already migrationary trends happening, Helmut, in the south of Namibia. There's already migrationary trends happening in Windhoek, migrationary trends happening at the coast. For those of us who are aware, when we travel throughout Namibia and we observe changes specifically in Walvis, Lüderitz, Swakopmund, Keetmanshoop, Windhoek, who's the other place? Apparently close to Usakus. There's developments happening there. Because one of the big concerns that you and I had last year was the land bill. Remember the land bill? And the aim of the land bill was trying to stop or to curb the selling of agricultural land to one of the aims. The selling of agricultural land to foreigners. But I'm hearing that local farmers are selling anyway to foreigners. And that thing is still in bill phase. And the farmers are now so clever, Helmut, they portion up their large commercial farm, they portion it up into smaller pieces, and they sell them as small plots. So that means it's like these small residential or estate-like arrangements. On this one big farm, you sell these small units. It's obviously instant cash injection mechanism, and you start seeing, you know, foreigners, not Namibian Germans, but Germans out of Europe, buying up these properties, living there, and starting living cozy. Now, at the heart of this discussion, what plans do we have? So for Usakus was supposed to address that specific need, because it's happening in the vicinity of Usakus. But what's going to happen to Karibab? What's going to happen to Arandas?
Oh, boy.
And all three of those towns, Helmut, were formerly built around the mining activities they had, not the farming activities.
Extractive?
So extractive is an issue. Extractive leaves a host or a government with a picking up the pieces scenario. We sit with another indication primarily of look what will also happen when that Oshikoto biomass power station, the one we did the power to X discussion last week for, if that power plant also gets into operation. And the presentation I sat through, the audios, did you listen to the audios or did you read the documents?
Which
one? The ones for the power to X that I sent you.
I think I listened to like one. You sent three audios.
Yeah, there were three. There were like three large audios. So in audio number 2 and 3, is where the actual presentations take place. The actual presentations about, okay, if Namibia wishes to produce green energy from a biomass plant, which technically is still you burning a plant and contributing carbon, but what they position close to the power plant, Helmut, is carbon capture.
That's the part I don't get about the whole
technology. No, it the smoke or the fume or the gas is converted into a liquid. So this means it's a closed system.
Okay.
It's like you having a steam pot, or think about your kettle. It's got water in it.
So it's somewhat condensed.
Yeah. So you have this thing in three phases, in three forms. You know the basic in physics that we learned on high school? You've got the thing either in a physical form.
Yeah, liquid and gas.
Yeah, in a solid or in a liquid form.
Yeah.
And then it gets put into a chamber or into a piece of equipment that converts it into a different state, which is the gaseous form. The gaseous form is then converted into a liquid form. So that you can see it's a completely closed.
It's a lot of condensation that's taking place.
Yeah, because you're changing it from, it's altering, you're almost altering the state.
Yeah.
The original state of the item that you used for the fuel source. So that thing's particular state gets changed into a gaseous form. The gas then is cooled down and is converted into a liquid form. And now the liquid, now you sit with liquid hydrogen. This is the first time I heard about liquid hydrogen, Helmut, at that presentation regarding the power tax. Liquid hydrogen's discussion now means you can choose, because that was on the documents, remember? They gave you three ways of transporting the green hydrogen projects, like products. It's either in the ammonia format or way, or it's in a gaseous form, or it's in a liquid form.
I would go with the liquid one.
Now, here's the discussion. Here is the actual discussion.
Anyone that didn't have a lot of friends in high school and spent a great deal of time in the lab understands just how kaboom hydrogen is.
No, Helmut, I mean, history is also full of kaboom-like examples, but we shouldn't fear it. I mean, like I said, even the mining guys, if you've had a dad that worked in the mining sector like my dad, they used to use the old canary way of testing for, what's that gas?
Is it testing for hydrogen?
No, not hydrogen. The other gas.
Is there for oxygen?
No.
Oxygen is the one that starts a fire.
The one that poisons, that immediately poisons miners. What was that gas's name? I almost said sulfuric acid. But it's a particular gas that they send a canary in a cage down. They don't fly. The canary doesn't fly down. Because obviously the canary now has the right to fly out. So they send the canary in a cage down the mine shaft, and they test.
Mine shaft is most likely to be sulfur.
I think it's sulfur also, but I forgot the particular gas. So they send the canary down, and then it might be methane as well.
Oh, it must be methane, because sulfur is in its natural state, it's a yellow solid.
Yeah. So they send the canary down, and if the canary comes back out and the canary is dead, then they know they have to close up a mine shaft because the miners won't be able to work. Yeah, it's toxic. And then they know they've got to work or develop a new mine shaft down a different direction. Now, that is an old way of doing things, an old technology, and it even has a specific phrase and idiom in English, modern English today. But it started from somewhere, and it started from an extractive activity because the guys didn't know where the methane or the various poisonous pockets that are natural gases, where they were. You didn't know, Helmut. Imagine in the 1800s, you're mining for copper or for gold.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't know that if you hit that wall, on the other side is a poisonous gas. You didn't know this. And this is literally the dangers that the miners went through. It's obviously a lot different from the miners that work in coal mines because they suffer from the specific resource that they're extracting, like black lung, is the most severe one. It's worse than being a cigarette smoker. They say literally that what you inhale, just one breath, Helmut, is so heavy with fossil fuel. Nah. It's like you were smoking, you know, that whole 20-pack cigarette carton that cigarettes are packed in, you know? It's like you smoking all that in one breath. And it literally, when they take scans of you, when the doctors take scans of you to test, to check how far your lungs are when it comes to coal miners, the doctors will explain to you that it's like you were rapidly smoking.
For the past 20 years.
No, but you were rapidly smoking for the past 20 years. That's how bad your lungs are.
Just from one inhaling.
Well, obviously how bad the condition will look, the doctors will tell you, but it's like you've been smoking 50 packs a day, trying to achieve or trying to reach lung cancer in some advanced form or not. So those are some of the developments. So we will clearly have pulling factors for rural to urban migration.
Mm-hmm.
We will clearly have it, Helmut. The question once again, and this is the most pivotal thing which is the light bulb moment of 2025 that I sat there thinking about, how important is the local and regional authority elections in Namibia? Which actually dawned on me, but these are the same, you can put up any particular expletive in there, these are the same clowns, these councillors, who are supposed to do urban planning, who are supposed to come up with mitigation strategies, who's supposed to come up with, hey, doesn't matter what part, political party I'm from, you've got to go talk to the Minister of Urban and Rural Development regarding, listen, we've got squatters, or we've got a shanty town developing on one side of our town. We would like to deal with it. Can we have an additional budget allocation to our current budget allocation? Because we realize there's an issue there, and it's a human rights issue. Helmut, for many parts of before you and I met here on the Home Run, I never understood what happened in Namibian, in the Namibian media landscape regarding how we looked at housing, affordable housing, and urbanization.
Okay, first of all, that's Dwight. Second,
people can come and climb. They can come and climb on my chest. Don't worry, guys. I will just won't give you my phone number. I like my peace.
Really? Not even if they're hot?
Well, if they're there to fight, Helmut, then things become awkward. So I'll just, you know, I'll maintain a neutral position. But still, people can come and argue, Helmut, because we're not dealing with core issues.
Okay, the urban to rural migration and how it will change the whole discussion around service delivery in a rural, I mean, in urban area.
Yeah.
Is something that I think can be traced back to the Industrial Revolution. What did the Industrial Revolution bring? It brought the, you know, it brought a very fundamental shift in a way that countries generate revenue. For a very long time, everything was dependent on strictly agriculture for the most part. Industrial Revolution brought about a breakthrough in a lot of scientific progress in terms of how to process things, which led to a skill-based economy, a shift from an agrarian one. That means now for to practice agriculture, you can't practice agriculture in an urban area.
Nope.
Agriculture is practiced outside of urban areas.
Even though City of Windhoek, remember,
at least in a, you know, on a large scale.
Yeah, I remember last year City of Windhoek launched that particular backyard garden campaign thing. Uh-huh. You and I were also like, now?
Okay, I've read a lot of articles about water usage. Now, I think, you know, if I was in charge, that's the last thing I'd be promoting. Now, look, you can't tell people, you know what, we have water scarcity, use water wisely, and then implement a method of, you know, implement a method of using, basically, you know, implement farming, which will use even more water. I'm seeing contradictions.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying. Now, the urban to rural, the rural to urban migration is something that can be traced to, what is a country's priority? Or what is a region's priority in terms of Africa? Africa is heavily reliant on what? And we are back to square one, the extractive industry. We don't invest a lot in agriculture. We don't invest a lot in education, not even in health. Compared to the extractive industry, education and health and agriculture and research and development, those ones are trailing way behind. So that means, the economy across the continent is largely based on scales based industrial related way of doing things than agrarian, than the traditional agrarian, form of doing things, which raises now one big question. If we are choosing a skills-based way of doing things as we shift away from the agrarian way of doing things, we want to industrialize, we want to build things, you know, build machines and, value addition in terms of, just extract a resource underground and then build something out of it.
Yeah.
And then sell that to make, to generate revenue out of it. Even though we are shipping most of it in raw form, our economy is heavily reliant on the extractive resources and more than it does on agriculture. And this is all across the continent. That is going to translate into a lot of urban to rural migration.
Yep.
And, one thing that you see is that, urban areas, for the most part, at least this is very true for countries like Namibia, you have a lot of urban areas that are intentionally set up next to the extractive industry sites. That brings to mind towns like Kombat and Arandes.
Mm.
So people will obviously move to towns that are associated, that are built next to opportunities Who wouldn't?
Yeah, who wouldn't?
Yeah, everyone will move. So the more, believe me, how to put this? If the oil exploration that are offshore, if they were onshore, there would be a town right next to it.
Yeah, and that is the big concern, Helmut, because what did the oil and gas governance guys say, the eco-dialogue guys? Yeah. It's pretty difficult to try and manage and monitor and evaluate what's happening over there 300 kilometers away.
Oh, look, it's very easy, right? All you just need is a, you know, it's a parliamentary standing committee made out of kavangos. Give them canoes, they will check it out. It's a good thing I'm from Kavango.
Where did that punchline come from, Helmut?
Sometimes it just pops out of the blue. Time to bring Chegaro to
Adi. Oh, no, that's just the worst. I didn't expect that.
Relax. We'll check it out.
A whole bunch of canoes. It's cold down there.
Huh?
It's cold on that ocean. Do you think those guys will even think about doing that? Still, nah.
Have you seen those waves?
Nah, this water is too cold. Nah. But no, but you are right.
For 300 kilometers.
Put someone on a boat.
Yeah.
To go and monitor. But luckily, that particular development is what, 2034 away, even those people are writing and talking like, you know.
Like it's tomorrow.
Like it's tomorrow or end of this week even, you know. And it's Helmut. I don't know what's going on, dude. I literally don't know.
We just want to be on time for the money, dude.
For who?
Our money.
The green hydrogen will be here quicker than the oil. And by then, since Namibia signed climate agreements, we put our names down, we had a minister go and sign things, we'll be held to those agreements. We'll be asked, now, why are you still exporting oil?
Well, we also have agreements to, you know what, to investors that we have, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, Helmut.
The oil exploration.
Yeah, Helmut. So
We also have agreements with those. So we just tell them, you know what, we'll handle this whole, you know, climate change thing. You just drill, baby, drill.
But we're telling that investor, the one in the renewable energy development sphere of things, yeah, we'll give you everything. Don't worry.
Yeah,
go for it. Just do your thing. Mm-hmm. And then literally, to find out, like I found out today, because I got a double shock. The shock that we walked in here with the Shelter Afrique Development Bank, which is older than the AU, and the particular agreement that was signed between Hyphen Namibia and GIZ, which is based upon a roadmap document, Helmut, that was already available back in 2021, and it literally builds off of the policy documents around the power to X and the policy documents around green hydrogen development.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular final phase is a phase of how about implementing, experimenting, developing, installing, and thus rolling out the fuel of the future. That's just why I'm calling green hydrogen the fuel of the future.
Mm-hmm.
Because Namibia will have a big issue, Helmut, with building a refinery onshore for the oil and gas. We can do the gas to power. We can do gas to power, ne?
Mm-hmm.
Because gas to power will at least give us an opportunity to expand into grey hydrogen. But we're not championing that. We're fixated on this oil. We're just squarely fixated on this oil thing.
Dude, we're just looking at resources that have made a lot of people a lot of kaching in a very short period of time.
I mean, it's making what? It's making Putin, since Putin's oil can now be somehow be sold back on the international market. Russia is now getting $700 million a day. $700 million a day, Hamid. How much money do you think that is? But where's Namibia? 2034. So, 700.
So, I think to some degree, low-key, we are wishing this conflict should have waited until 2034.
Best case scenario. But we weren't there. We did not know. So
you better hope I'm not president by 2034, because I'll just pay some, some warlord somewhere who is running a global choke point to start a war.
Helmut, you'll be the president that will literally send his minister on a canoe to go and look at, to go and investigate the oil rigs 300 kilometers away.
Do you have any idea how high the platform is?
Do you know, do you have any idea how difficult the water is between Ludritz and where those oil rigs will be?
Yeah.
You literally, you'll be the guy who will send your minister out on a dinghy.
Yeah.
And tell him, yeah, you, your PA and, your deputy minister, you guys, I can see you there.
Yeah.
Work on your muscles. 300 kilometers. Yeah. No. We can't be that brutal, Helmut. Human rights, remember? Human rights.
You're not gonna get anywhere, you know, I don't think you'll even cover 100 meters.
Look, you can get out of the port. You'll be able to get out of the harbor at Ludritz.
Mm-hmm.
It's between the harbor and where your destination is. That's where your issue lies.
When it comes to that very awesome joke that came out of the blue, your biggest problem would be the logistical nightmare of moving God knows how many canoes from Kavango to Ludritz.
Why? No. Dude, no.
You know, with abnormal tracks.
That's why I said dinghy. I didn't say canoes. Canoes stay where they are. In Kavango region. Oh, in one of the two Kavango regions. Because they're no longer one. So, yeah. But a dinghy will be dubious. But as you highlighted there.
Yeah.
There is a lot more that we will have to do, Helmut, because we've got all these things taking place in our borders. And even though, did you get to the part where William Ruto was having a wonderful discussion with the person interviewing him, the lady?
No.
So Ruto was explaining now that it was a scenario, yeah, there in Kenya. Kenya is known for having Africa's largest slum. That's now the slum outside Nairobi.
Yeah.
The one that literally conjoins onto. And the very poor sanitary conditions that people live under in those slums in Nairobi. Now, the concern was there, Helmut, you could literally see, okay, so why is this president, why is he fixated on a local authority issue? What is his local authority in Kenya doing? That was not being highlighted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is the same thinking you have to apply, for example, to the local authorities in Windhoek. Yeah, not Windhoek, sorry. In Namibia. Being, like you highlighted, 1 year, City of Windhoek will come and tell you, please save water, save water, save water. And then in that same year, they're telling you, please start a backyard garden.
And you're like, okay, which one is which?
Am I going to pay for the water for the backyard garden? Definitely, you are. You know, this is your erf. We're going to hold you responsible. And then you say, but you just told me to save water. What's the problem? Do you know what I discovered the other day of the water meters at your property? Is they've got a limit of numbers. Meaning, it only tallies up to a specific limit.
Before you don't have water?
No, before it stops billing you.
At that time, I can imagine the bills are through the ionosphere.
But how can they charge you if the determining factor stopped working? Because it's based on those numbers.
Look, I know, take for example, just take one of those mercury thermometers. Let's say it goes up to 100 degrees.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Imagine it just gets stuck.
Yeah.
At its 100.
Yeah, when it's 100 degree measurement.
When
it's at 100, you really have to get worried. Is this the maximum temperature or is this the maximum the thermometer can go? Oh boy.
It's not about the maximum number. It stopped working at its 100th reading of 100 degrees Celsius.
Yeah, that means you could be hotter than that.
Its 100th reading of 100 degrees Celsius means it has reached a threshold. That's how they manufacture these devices. I didn't know that a USB flash drive apparently has 100,000 memory reads, meaning 100,000 times you putting in the memory stick, copying off, 100,000 times. It has got a limit. I did not know this.
Jeez, who even counts?
The manufacturer of the device, who bought it from the person who owns the intellectual property of the schematics.
Makes sense.
So, The discussion also is one about, are we looking ahead? Are we looking into the future and saying, you know what, Windhoek, you probably need to split up into three municipalities. Because I'm really trying to understand what Groothoop is doing in the whole scheme of things. Groothoop needs its own municipality. Groothoop, literally, Helmut, has to be a local authority by itself. Because if you drive from here to Groothoop, 30 kilometers, and you're still within city limits of Windhoek, does it make sense to you, Helmut? Do you think Windhoek will expand past Leopard Valley, which is this army base here on the way to Rehoboth? No, Windhoek won't expand. Do you think Windhoek will expand past in a straight line? No? From Kleine Cooper? No, let's say from the Grove Mall, in a straight line to where you can see Heroes Acre. Do you think Windhoek will expand into that up and down rocky areas and stuff, past Leopard Valley, into the sphere or into the perimeter or close to the perimeter of Heroes Acre? Mm-hmm. No, Windhoek won't expand that way. So where in which wisdom did we think we have, since I'm a Windhoek native, the developmental capability to say, okay, because according to law, that's now Local Authorities Act, every local authority in the country has a 50-kilometer radius around itself, which is its city or local authority limits. Now, ask yourself, Helmut, do you think there is a capability to say Groothoop itself should be a subject to the organization and governance of the city? Or should it have its... Because it has its own name, Helmut. It's not the city of Windhoek Groothoop. It's Groothoop. It's not Groothoop of city of Windhoek. It's Groothoop. Meaning it's big... Groothoop. It's Big Brother. Its name is actually Big Brother.
Oh.
It's Big Brother. It's not the Big Brother of city of Windhoek. It's not city of Windhoek's Big Brother. It's just Groothoop. It's just Groothoop. Just like you've got... What's the other guy's name? The other development this way to the airport. So the airport, Hosea Kotako, is within the city limits of Windhoek. Because it's 30 kilometers away. The radius is 50 kilometers. Now 50 kilometers, Helmut, should tell you obviously, okay, then try stopping the city limits. Because you can clearly see with this new highway expansion, there are still farms between... there are farms here from there's a farm here 2 kilometers out from Windhoek. From Droombos, which is a entertainment center. Just here on the other side of this, on your way to the airport.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the founding father has his farm. One of his farms, almost one of the farms here in close proximity that border literally onto the city limits, is within the city's purview. But we didn't expand that way. We're expanding in that direction, westwards.
Yeah.
That's where we're expanding, Helmut. And we're expanding slightly here, eastwards here, into this Gramadulas of volcanic activity here, this here, eastwards, behind, you know, Avis. We're expanding there. So, Windhoek in its own right should come to a realization. You know what? Things are not as straightforward as it is. Start decentralizing your activity. Now, here's the bigger aim. Here's the bigger problem. That William Ruto discussion there with the second Africa Union Urban Forum, Urbanization Forum, was that Ruto was speaking about things that, which were operational.
Yeah.
But then why do you have a local authority?
Okay.
So the president must now come and fix a porthole, Helmut.
Some painful numbers were pointed out Development Bank, Shelter Africa Development Bank.
Yeah.
Mr. Habib Han. You know, there's a lot of, you know, just all protocol observed. But, you know, he begins by pointing out that Kenya is a regional hub for urban investment and innovation, particularly in housing. At this point, I'm going, right. Also with the biggest slum.
Yeah.
I'm going to come back to that statement, but he does dive into, you know, to a housing issue, especially in terms of the money that's required to solve that housing issue all across the continent. And we all know Africa faces a $1.4 to $4 trillion housing gap. That's when I went, yeah, we're not solving this one.
We're not.
Yeah, housing gap and forums like this, in reference to the Africa, you know, the urbanization forums now. Forums like this brings together governments, financiers, and private sector to unlock solutions. Again, I feel like we are not looking at the problem. We are trying to solve the problem by creating business opportunities. This is the problem that, this is the reason why the shelter Afrique is older than the African Union, but there's still a lot of, people without shelter all across the continent. It keeps bringing us to the to the question of affordability.
Yeah,
it's not housing that's lacking. There are houses all across the continent. They are just built with so much value. There are not a lot of people that can afford them.
But then, what's the issue with South Africa, Hamoud? Why does South Africa have, like I told you,
yeah,
this earth where yeah, our studio is built on? This earth in Windhoek standards is close to 2 million or 2 million plus.
Mm-hmm.
But for 2 million Namibian dollars, you can buy 3-5 houses in middle-class neighborhoods in Cape Town, in Johannesburg, in Pretoria, or even in Bloemfontein. And you will still have change. You will still have change from that 2 million, Helmut.
And again, we are back to square one. If I die of hunger today because I don't have food,
yeah,
is it does Namibia have food security issue or did I just have a problem of means of access? Because if you have money, the food is there. The problem is if you don't have the means of access, which is the money, then there is no food for you.
Yeah.
Again, we are back to square one. It's not that we don't have food. We have food.
It's the supply. Okay, Namibia's
issue. The means of access to the food.
Namibia's issue is obviously the procurement, supposedly.
Oh, boy.
Because, you know, Minister Shafuda realized it last year with, for her, just before, when she did the civil society engagement, the 30% rollout of the development budget, as well as also previous ministers of finance and other ministers who realized things are a bit sluggish. The Oshikati High Court is a very good example, you know. Procurement is an issue.
Procurement is an issue.
We know.
And
we,
the amendments of the procurement.
We know all the people, but it's useless in trying to cut corners if ACC, the new revamped, revamped and now outperforming himself, ACC, because today there was another notice sent about, and this was an employment thing, Hamoud, a ministerial official. It's like I'm applying for a government job, and you're the HR officer in that ministry, and you're like, "Yeah, I'll get you the job, Dwight, if I'll make sure that you get the preferential treatment that you need, and you know you'll score the points, and then just pay me off after you get."
You see, that's the reason why I don't look. Just hear me out. This is just my point of view. That's the reason why I don't participate in all this betting thing.
Yeah.
Because my fear is there's someone that's working there in
who knows, the bookkeeper.
Who knows the bookkeeper, who knows someone.
No, not the bookkeeper, who knows the bookie.
And they are helping someone who is just somewhere out there that, you know, just you win it and then we split. That's just maybe me being paranoid, but that's basically where we are at when it comes to greed.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult to say what really is transparent and what's not.
Yeah.
So they found someone trying to pull that off?
Yes, Hamoud.
Oh, boy.
So, which probably could mean that the whole public sector or the whole civil, whole
public service could be under scrutiny for just exactly that kind of treatment. Wonderful times. However.
Yeah, when you're not the one. Oh,
yeah, when you're not the one.
Yeah.
So we're looking at a scenario, Helmut, of potentially, you know, what's actually happening with regarding the localized legislation that you have and goals that we set for ourselves. So we have NDB6. But NDB6 says where it wants to be, and it took stock of a situation where it was. But we don't, we have a vague idea of what the roadmap looks like. The roadmap says try to build from this position, Helmut, to this very strong position.
Yeah.
Like, for example, when we did the lotteries discussion, they somehow mixed up actual video game sector with gaming, which was technically gambling.
Yeah.
Gambling and betting. And
so basically, gaming for recreation and gaming for money.
Yeah. Which is also recreation. Which is also escapism.
Recreation slash maybe
addiction.
Get some of the.
But somehow.
At least you are, I mean, you are running double addiction there, you know, gambling addiction and a gaming addiction.
Yeah.
All I can deal with is the gaming one.
But here's the thing. Every time you switch on your phone,
mm.
or you switch on your tablet, because you use your tablet to play your video game.
Yeah.
Every time you switch on your tablet, your tablet consumes your data.
Yeah.
So that means it's money flowing away from the central measurement of gaming.
Yeah.
You're not spending money on gaming, but you're spending money in
indirectly
on background operations. So you are spending money per gigabyte to your internet service provider.
Yeah.
End of the month, Helmut has to pay Doc out an additional amount, or it looks very reasonable and it's within your budgetary means.
Mm-hmm.
You go like, oh, this is nice. I'm going to continue gaming on my tablet. And then the second thing is that Helmut's battery on his tablet is being depleted quicker.
Yeah.
So you are recharging more.
Replacing.
You're recharging more, not replacing. You're recharging more electricity from NamPower. NamPower says, oh, there's more money for us.
Everyone needs a PlayStation.
Keep it up, Helmut. Even worse if you get that thing. Because they increased the price by 20%. The new PlayStation, if you did not know. So now it's within the, like, 20,000, 24,000, 25,000 price range, potentially. But anyway.
Nah.
And if you look at what else you still spend money on, now you have to buy more airtime, more data, and all that stuff. You're spending money in other facilitating functions.
Yeah.
However, it's not what was measured in NDP6. That's why it's one of the few sort of like flaws in NDP6 where you go like, but this is gambling and betting. Or this is lotteries, which is gaming or slash gambling and betting. Because it's a game of chance. But here's the thing which that provides, which is you don't even need a roadmap. All you need to do is you need to say, hey, listen, is there somebody with 100 million out there? With a couple of 100 million. Because my budgeting technically puts it in the range of 300 million. Not just the 100 million you need. Even though the legislation says you need the 100 million to show the guarantee.
That's it.
But you need like another 100 million to set up shop, hire people, pay for salaries and taxes and stuff, because Namra obviously wants its cut, always. And you need to provide actual proof of longevity to the government.
Yeah.
So that means that's a large-scale investment coming about, which is, once again, the seismic survey scenario.
Oh, yeah.
You need 300 million.
Guys.
So it's not easy. But that is a lot quicker, Helmut, to get off the ground than getting into mining.
You need 100. That 100 million that you're spending, obviously for, like you just pointed out, it's more of a guarantee.
Yeah.
And you have to fork out extra for your operations and stuff. That has a way better chances of turning out positive than the extractive industry, because 300 million, it's for the seismic survey guys to conduct their survey to tell you whether or not there is oil. They can do that seismic survey and tell you, well, thank you very much for the 300 million, but there's no oil here. So have a good day.
Yeah.
I think that's more painful.
No, it is.
Yeah. It
literally is. And, you know, when we have to look at the combination, the balancing of actual development, which is, I put it closer to urbanization and how you balance urbanization and economic development. Urbanization, Helmut, always suffers. It always suffers. And since we're not producing much data about housing, and specifically property sales, because the lovely resource that I had, I now have to go and ask them, hey, listen, is there a way that I can access your lovely research reports that you keep producing? You're just sending me the email, but if I click on that button, I'm being asked, please log in. And I have to now go and negotiate there as well in terms of, hey, listen, will you be able to, and it's a Namibian investment house. They give these lovely reports and analyses. But at the heart of this discussion, we are already missing a big goal. And the goal is, how do you achieve affordable housing? And plus you're giving an adequate supply into the housing market.
Keyword, affordable housing. We are back to affordability again, because my take has always been, it's no, we don't have a food insecurity problem. We have a means to access the food problem. And we don't have a housing problem. There are a lot of housing, and there are a lot of construction companies that are just on standby. Just show up with your money and, guarantee finance. You just give them the money, and then they can just set up a whole structure for you.
Mm.
The thing is, there are not a lot of us that have that, that amount of money to basically build the house from scratch.
Mm.
And that creates a market for all the rental, market. But now we are trying to solve a housing problem by thinking about it as a business. It's a good thing to think about it, to think about it as a business. But it's also, I think it's important to be mindful of how the two are different. One tries to solve a housing problem, for development, and the other tries to solve a housing problem for profit.
Mm.
And one that's dominating the industry right now is one that's running on profit. So. And also, as in everything else, the housing also has its own market. And it's influenced both internally and externally by a lot of, it's influenced by both a lot of internal and external, external issues. Now, if you have money, you can have one. But if you don't have money, you can't have one. Yeah. That goes to show that the problem is not the house, it's the money. So that brings about the affordability question. Now, the gentleman Mr. Habib Han, or doctor.
He's not a medical doctor. Just keep that Mr.
Yeah, he's Mr. Even on the script, he's Mr. He's pointing out here, Kenya, after pointing out that, what's that? Yeah, after pointing out how much Africa needs to spend.
Yeah.
We all know Africa faces a 1.4 to 4 trillion housing gap. And then he goes into congratulating the forum. Then he shifts from congratulating the forum in terms of finding solutions to Africa's housing problem.
Mm.
And shifts to congratulating William Ruto. Your Excellency, we have delegations from all over Africa. And some from Azerbaijan. Nice. Let's just tell everyone we're homeless.
And Azerbaijan shows up and promotes, next month we will have the world... What was the thing's name? The UN thing? The World Habitat or World something, Housing something Forum. I was like, my goodness.
We have themes for everything. Now, then he goes on to say that all shareholders and members of Shelter Africa Development Bank, all shareholders and members...
Namibia is one of them.
Member or shareholder?
We're a member nation.
Yeah. Members of Africa Development Bank, which you are graciously hosting here in Nairobi for the past 44 years since 1982.
Oh, 1982. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Not 1946. Yeah. Yo, I would have gone like, yo. Yo.
Since 1982. So it's a privilege to be standing here this morning, Your Excellency, to welcome all the delegates from all over Africa. Everything is so far so good. And then he goes through, Kenya is now a benchmark for affordable housing, thanks to your leadership. Affordable housing?
But you still have the biggest slum on Africa. Are we now just, are we now just trying to tick the boxes by just saying, at least throw out a few comments and compliments there so as to make the Kenyan president feel good?
Yeah, that's exactly what Homeboy was doing there.
Because I'll tell you this, Helmut. When I give you the example of what's happening in South Africa, that, like it has been explained to me, South Africa is a buyer's market. A buyer's market, Helmut, is that you will always find a bargain for your price, for your budget. In Namibia, go talk to any husband, wife, any couple, any recently married couple in Namibia.
Yeah.
It's a nightmare, specifically in Windhoek and at the coast. It's a nightmare.
Oh, yeah. It's a nightmare.
To qualify for the bank loan. Secondly, to get the right property for you. Because everyone is out to literally teach you a lesson. Everybody is out there to try and get their iPhone, which is dual SIM card capabilities, from you. That's what they want. You know, it's because it's obviously a unicorn. A unicorn is an item that doesn't exist. It's a non-existent item, so the price will be high that you will face, you and your wife. So, I'm sorry, guys. I'm talking about obviously people that have jobs and that have access to bank financing, because that is the template that is being measured. It's not the template of you coming in from the rural to urban migrationary trends. It's actually people that have been working in the formal economy.
And we are back to affordability.
Once again, because the formal economy is being based upon, what can we serve to the formal economy? It's not about what can we serve to the informal economy. It's not what we can serve to the informal settlements of Namibia. That's not the planning, Helmut. We have to identify that as well. And that's what many, even our MPs in parliament, are forgetting. Because they will show up with a discussion, Helmut, but you're not the same economic level as someone that potentially lives in an informal settlement.
Yeah.
You're not. You are both Namibians.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not the same kind of citizen. You're not the same person with the same kind of things.
Yeah.
Now, here's the discussion. City of Windhoek will budget for you. I'll say it again, Helmut. They will budget for you. You went to higher education. You finished school. You speak English very well. Like I've been told by one of our colleagues here. Yeah, Dwight, don't think that just because you can speak like have that fancy British accent of yours. I'm not the one rah-rah-ing, you know, trying to sound like a rah-rah-rah. No.
Oh, really? Now I know who you're talking about.
No, I laughed at him. But the economy, Helmut, the economists, the financial planners in Namibia, even the public and civil servants plan for you. They plan for you. You passed high school. You went to university. You've got a formal job. You are spending money in the economy. They plan for you. They're not planning
for the informal
settlements.
Look, one painful question you just had to bring up, because I didn't think of it, is when we say informal, what do you mean? Because that shows a lack of preparation
exactly.
In terms of your, you know, urban expansion.
Exactly.
That's what it shows.
Exactly. And that's why I said a little bit earlier in our discussion, I threw the ball immediately in the court of the local authorities. Because it means that they've got officials there who are once again just treating their jobs like, like holiday sessions, just earning a salary without providing proof for the work. I mean it. I've seen a poor service delivery, specifically in local authorities. I've known it from Rehoboth to here. And obviously with my sister now moving back to Rehoboth, I'll hear the stories once again. I love those stories because those stories show to me how people don't understand the role that they play in service delivery because it's human to human. The health sector is not the health sector to help a human. It's human to human. And that's what the banks also forget. The banks forget that I want to have an app on my phone, which literally means they have the better the better, what you call a peace of mind of plausible deniability, because then they can say, yeah, but it's because you gave your phone to your girlfriend. Your girlfriend kept sending herself e-wallets. And you're wondering what happened to my money and my budget. Because the banks can tell you straightforward to your face. Yeah, but your girlfriend kept sending herself e-wallets. Whose number? Oh my goodness, my girlfriend's number. Voila, there you go. So, the private sector, Helmut, is trying to convert the situation of human-to-human interactions in terms of, you know, economic activity there, or commercial activity. Let me not say economic. Commercial activity there. Now, the public service is somehow forgetting that they are human-to-human engagement. Literally human-to-human engagement. For example, if you're an ambulance driver, you're helping a fellow human. You're not helping an alien that landed, because that's a unicorn. You're not driving an empty ambulance around for the fun of it. That's a waste of petrol. So you're responding to needs. Now, in that scenario, Helmut, once again, the economy, the economic planners, and a lot of them sit in South Africa, by the way, all of them are planning for you and me, for Happy that did the On the Radar, for David that's coming on after, for Hende that did his sports show yesterday on a Sunday evening. The economic planners of Namibia is planning for us. They're not planning for Tom and Dick and Harry, who didn't finish high school, but they're living in a rural area, who refused to go and improve their high school marks and then tried to, you know, then build their lives from there. They will not plan for those people. They will say, you the government, central government of Namibia, you plan for those people. You sort them out. And then it's Tom, Dick and Harry that will migrate to Windhoek. Come and stay in an informal settlement. And the unfortunate thing is, they won't have access to proper jobs and proper paying jobs with the minimum wage limit even. Mm-hmm. And they'll be unskilled because, firstly, they didn't pass grade 12. So there's nothing a future employer can do because the person didn't pass grade 12.
You can't even bribe a human resources practitioner.
Not even properly. Okay. You can't even falsify your grade 12 even with a lack of financing that you pointed out to.
To try and
be a clever IT guy there on your grade 12 certificate to try and get a government job, even you won't be able to.
You know what's one of the documents? One of the type of documents being mostly falsified in the US, especially I think it's New York.
What?
Title deeds.
No, but that's disputes, estate disputes, and disputes around significant amounts of money and assets.
Those are not disputes in relation to, say, for example, sales or selling or inheritance. These are just total strangers that I don't know how they are putting their hands on property information that's supposed to obviously be private. Next thing you know, you're just in your house and someone is telling you, well, I have a title deed to this property, get out.
Helmut, and
that's smelling a lot of inside job for me.
No, it is. It definitely is. But here's where you can always have faith. Many people forget that if you sit with a testament document or with an estate document of a deceased person, which shows, what's there, or the deed. Title deeds, because a title deed is part of an estate, and an estate is obviously part of a testament document. We call it testaments in Afrikaans, but it's even an English word. So, when it comes to estate disputes, many people forget many cases. A lot of the older generations actually made multiple copies of the same document.
Multiple copies?
Yeah. So you would give a copy to your bank manager, tell them, keep that copy. That's a copy of this original document.
Yeah.
You, the owner of the estate, you keep the original. And you give a copy of, you give another copy to, let's say, an executor. Let's say you were someone that you're elderly and you're sickly.
Mm-hmm.
And you can obviously see, the end of time for your personal, your time on earth. And then you start counseling and you start advising and you start getting in touch with professionals in the economy. And one of them would be an executor.
Yeah.
An executor speeds up the process of obviously handing over your assets and your various assets and various whatever you're leaving behind for your beneficiaries, speeding up that process. Now, the old school way was writing multiple copies of the same document. You give one to a trusted executor, you give another copy to another trusted executor, and you give another one to someone else. That way, if a dispute arises between the beneficiary, the beneficiaries, né? And one beneficiary decides to take the original document and literally goes and alters it and writes something completely different. And I've heard of such cases, which is criminal. And I know you've heard of such cases.
There are a lot.
Yeah. So it's criminal. It's already a criminal act the person is committing.
Yeah.
Because the High Court of Namibia or the Supreme Court of Namibia can literally send that person to jail. So the biggest concern is the old school method. So if one of the beneficiaries commits this act of forgery and fraud, and they show up and they say, yeah, my dad and mom left everything to me, and you, the other siblings, you get nothing. Then the actual executors will show up when the person who is the owner of the estate had passed away. The actual executors show up with the documents, with the various copies, and they will come and show, listen, we all have the same copy. Why are you, Helmut, sitting with a different version of something? And just there, you get arrested.
Mine is the original.
You forfeit.
You're all wrong.
You get nothing. You get thrown in jail. So, yeah, it does happen, but the Americans are pretty strong, Helmut, and they know how to defend people through their legal system.
One thing that was pointed out in one of those, a video I watched, I think that was from CNBC, was the advancement in technology and how easy it is becoming more and more, more and more becoming to forge a document.
Yeah.
So technology is making it way easy to basically forge a document, but that's in the title deed USA direction. But one advice that was given is that if you own a property, any of your relative that has properties, it's advisable to keep to be up to date with your property status in terms of information where it's stored. Obviously pay all the dues and see if your information is still intact, and if there are any suspicious activities, then you report them in time to see if someone at least tried to duplicate your title deed, then it can be picked up on time.
Mm.
Because a lot of people that are falling prey to that scam, if I can call it that, those people that has haven't, it seems like it's mostly deceased individuals and people that are the elderly. And those that have, obviously this property, these are properties with records that have not been looked at or updated or sort of like reviewed in a very long time, a year or two. So they just pick that up and like, okay, you know what, this is, make for an easy target.
No, it does. Yeah. It does. And obviously part of estates is always also property somewhat because, I have not seen any statistic which looks at how much of Namibia's economy is actually locked up in real estate.
Ooh, that's going to be huge.
But one of the guys that I follow, Gary Stevens, and Gary can immediately talk about how much of a country's economy is locked up in real estate or in properties. And it's safe to assume that Namibia has a confusing template because we've got communal land areas where, for tomorrow morning, our colleague Matthias is going to be talking about illegal communal land sales taking place. So he's obviously going to have a discussion. I'm just promoting you, Matthias. Please, I'll send you the invoice a little bit later. Helmut and I would like, I don't want to say bribe here live on air, but we'd like our palms greased, just to let you know. But he's going to have a discussion about that, which plays a central discussion, even what we're talking about, urbanization and migrationary trends and stuff like that. At the heart of it, Helmut, is how powerful money has become in the Namibian concept or in the Namibian economy, primarily because we realized, like with the malnutrition discussion, It's accessibility to money, not accessibility to food. Yeah, you can walk into the shop. If you don't have money, yeah, you and the securities will have Mike Tyson fight night sessions there at the front door.
Yep.
Definitely.
Yeah, but shelves are full of food.
But the shelves are full of food.
Yeah.
They're full of food. The only existential crisis that we currently are not talking about, which you cannot talk about because it's not within our power to try and solve it, is because of the Strait of Hormuz, with some of the well-known economists actually outlining, hey, listen, if this war goes on, and if the United States actually commits to boots-on-ground invasion in Iran, some countries will face severe famines. Not manufactured famines,
mm-hmm.
natural famines.
This is going to lead to... this is not going to help the protectionism fear that a lot of countries were having. Because to, and we saw this during the COVID-19 pandemic. A lot of countries like, you know, Egypt was like, you know what... I think it was Egypt that said, okay, you know what, we'll just sell the, you know, our products, you know, produce like chicken here at home before we start looking at external markets, because we also have, you know, a hunger situation here because of the pandemic. And India did the exact same thing with wheat. And we are most likely to see the same thing when it comes to all the chaos, being caused out of the Middle East. But one thing that's going to come from this is just ask yourself one question: what we are fearing, the Cubans have, for them it has been a lifestyle.
Mm.
Same true for Iran, for to some degree. For them it has been, you know, economic blockades. Crushes your economy. That means you now have to figure out other ways of, of having water access, energy access, food access. You have to basically figure out new ways of doing all these things, which is why, automotive-wise, you know, Cuba is locked in the 1950s and 60s.
Yep.
You know, they still have they drive cars that have not been out of production for decades.
Yep.
And for some reason, they still keep them running.
Oh, no, there's a guy. There's a mechanical or
How
auto
do they
engineer.
Get the parts?
There's an auto engineer there in Havana. Not Havana, Namibia. Havana, Cuba.
Yeah.
Who literally built a coal-powered steam engine for his Fiat 500, which a 1980s Fiat 500. It's like a whole little, it looks like a whole little chimney situation at the back of the car. He built it, Helmut, and he re-engineered the car because of the
plan on his alternative fuel.
On coal.
Yeah.
Literally.
Now, that's what, they say, I think it's inconvenience breeds innovation. Or is it convenience breeds innovation? The thing is, there's a breeding of innovation that comes out of it. Take the weapons that Iran is using, for example. One of them is especially the drones. They are noisy because they are running a motorbike engine.
Yep. The Shahid drones.
Yep.
Yeah. And where do they get motorbike engines? Who's the world's biggest motorbike engine manufacturer?
China.
No.
Japan.
Yes.
Oh, both. Really? Japan?
It's even the Vietnam, these guys in Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
They are also, they're also a huge market for motorcycle engines because that's where the motorcycle engine market is so strong there. And it's the same thing about the Mitsubishi Bakis and the Toyota Bakis that showed up in the Yemen war around the Abrams tank. You know, all the Japanese guys said was, Japanese manufacturer said was, hey, we see this massive order coming through from Dubai. They don't know that the customer is standing in front of the salesperson in Dubai telling, hey, listen, here's like a couple of million US dollars. We'd like about 400 Toyota Land Cruiser Bakis.
Yeah.
How about you ship them in immediately? And then Toyota has to run around pulling Bakis from Australia, from Japan, from Thailand, and the Philippines, just to feed that big order heading there to Dubai. Gets to Dubai, yeah, it's the Houthi rebels from Yemen. Would you look at that? And they drive it out from there. They drive it from there back to their base in Yemen. It's a similar thing, Ahmed, because you then go and ask the question, oh, no, I'm taking this too far. I'm sorry. rewind, scratch what happened, scratch what I just explained. Iran has 2-3 car companies.
Come again.
Iran builds their own cars.
Yep.
So Iran can make its own engines. And Iran can re-engineer, repurpose, reverse engineer any mechanical engine or combustion engine or technology out there.
Look,
so,
man.
That is the summary I wanted to outline.
Look, man, when I looked at the negotiation teams, I knew this thing was going to go south. First of all, these guys are all advanced degree holders. And not just that, these guys have not only just spent an extended period of academic, dedication to everything that they are going to talk about in these negotiations. Sitting across the table is someone that is in real estate. Mm. Self-proclaimed diplomatic.
Who's a trust fund baby. No, let's be honest.
Thank you very much. Thank you for pointing that part.
Because he doesn't even have a degree on his name.
And I was like, what on... look, that's why I concluded...
Okay, it does. I'm lying. It does, actually. Jared Kushner.
The U.S. No, these guys don't want to negotiate. They don't want to negotiate because if they did, they would have sent... Because that's what happened during the Obama administrations.
Mm.
They had experts in the field of nuclear and diplomacy to basically show up for these negotiations.
Mm.
And that's the same thing that I believe was happening throughout the entire Biden administration. And I'm looking at these guys and like, okay, first of all, a lesson that should have been learned here is these are the guys that were sent to the negotiations before the bomb started exploding.
Mm.
And you think now that they have mastered all of a sudden in this very short time span, they have mastered the art of negotiation to go and stop the war that started because of their failure to negotiate. The irony is it was Donald Trump that was making fun of, that was basically criticizing Biden that he's going to start a war with Iran because of his inability to negotiate.
Mm.
And then the war with Iran starts because of his inability to negotiate during his administration.
Yeah.
Have a feeling I'll make a better politician than most politicians in this planet.
But it's about achieving actual goals, Helmut. But before we continue, we'll quickly take a live read. Velvice University for the 2026 July applications that are now open for the Faculty of Health Sciences for the postgraduate diploma in Community Health Nursing Level 8. Admission requirements indicate that candidates must have a recognized nursing qualification at NQF level 7 or higher from any recognized higher learning institution. Candidates must also be a registered nurse or midwife. Must also be a registered nurse or midwife with the Nursing Council of Namibia or the Health Professions Council of Namibia. Candidates must also have a minimum of 2 years working experience as a nurse or midwife in any health facility. And candidates must write a short essay describing the motivation for pursuing the postgraduate diploma in community health nursing. Qualification period or duration is 1 year and the mode of delivery is full time. For more information, please call 081-403-6406, Velvice University, where everyone is an achiever.
As in everything else that we'll basically discuss on a regional or continental level, it all boils down to one thing. Money.
Yeah, it does.
Money.
Yeah, it does.
$4 trillion.
Yeah.
US dollars.
And that is also telling us we really need to update that housing backlog discussion, because what is our housing backlog? What are we doing? And it's not just Vintu that has to solve this. And this is one of the core concerns here. It's not just Vintu that has to solve this. It's Okahania. It's Swakop. It's Walvis Bay. It's Usikus. It's Arandas. It's all these main towns that you find connected to Namibia's main road networks.
Yeah.
They have to play their part. Because, Helmut, we are unfortunately... We are developing in an unequal scenario. What I mean by this is Windhoek is getting the larger chunk of most developments.
Yeah.
And then it's leaving scraps to the smaller local authorities. And I mean the speech back when we had the interim CEO, what was the guy's name? Mayumbelo at City of Windhoek. I forgot, it was a George or something.
I think it's George Mayumbelo.
Yeah. He gave a speech that year, Hamoud, when he was interim CEO. He said, Windhoek collects the biggest of the local authorities, collects the most for state coffers, state revenue, through the local authorities. Because the local authority is a revenue mechanism for the government. Windhoek collects the most. And yet, Windhoek is treated like the other local authorities are treated on the level of Windhoek. Which is an unequal approach to take, Hamoud. This is not law where everyone is equal before the same law. No, this is, since you produce the most income, you have to get your fair share of the biggest pie for your needs.
Making it sound like you should start running it like a shareholder thing. Like,
but it is.
The more shares you have.
But it is a shareholder discussion. The more dividend you get. It actually is a shareholder discussion now. Yeah. But it seems more from what he said that day back in 2021 or 2022. What he said that day, Hamoud, was so key and so telling that in this discussion that we're having here 4 or 5 years later, obviously since he's moved away from the position, now it's someone else that's CEO, where he highlighted in Namibia itself, how the guy that produces the most money is treated like the guy that has to stand at the back of the queue, asking for, please help me with my budget. But instead, they should be treated like the guy in the front of the queue. Meaning, since you have provided the most, you get the first say. Give us your first demands. Give us your first requirements, what you need. Instead of treating you like the guy standing in last in line. So this means, Hamoud, there's an unequal distribution of the same resource, government budgeting across the country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what has been laid out? That particular tour that I took last year through northern Namibia, how I looked at town planning and town layout from towns like Enana to Onipa, to what's that other settlement that I also asked the question? No, it was Onipa where I asked the question, is Onipa going to identify itself as being part of Ondangwa? Or is there some sort of a dispute between Onipa and Ondangwa? Well, what's the gist here? Well, why does Onipa exist, Hamoud? Because you can fly through Onipa, and then you don't know when you entered it, you don't know when you exited it, but you find yourself just in Ondangwa, just like that. So Onipa also has to just come to reality and ask itself, because Onipa is not even Grootop. It's not that far away from Ondangwa. Onipa is not even Grootop. Onipa is literally, you don't know where the local authority lines end.
Uh-huh.
But it's a settlement on itself. So then where does the 50 kilometer radius regarding local authority limits, where does it apply and where does it not apply? Or you get to the weird scenario. What was the other weird one? Like Okumbaye on the other side of Omaruru. Mm. Hamoud, Omaruru, you can stand on one side of Omaruru's road. You can throw a stone and you'll hit a bush on the outside of Omaruru. But if you go to Okumbaye, which is just 20 kilometers on a gravel road from Omaruru to Okumbaye, Okumbaye is a thriving, lovely, rather neglected settlement. And I know it's where the Damara traditional authority or king lives or resides. But if Okumbaye just got the added level of recognition to be classified as an actual settlement, a formal settlement, because there are so many people clustered there. Hamoud, you would have this well-hidden gem sitting there close to the Irongo Mountains. So we sit with this unequal, unproperly planned approach to the actual issues that we are trying to combat.
We are talking about solving a housing problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Urbanization, but yeah. We're not answering urbanization's problems.
No, we're not. That's the part, because We want to run it in a way, and I think that's true for the whole continent again. We want to solve the housing problem in a way that does not disrupt the money that's heavily embedded in the housing market.
Yeah.
Yep. And the prices are just going to go through the roof. And one thing that was pointed out in the Panama Papers is how a lot of the money that was uncovered to have gone missing in basically all across the continent, I mean all across the planet, in the in the Panama Papers, where a lot of celebrities and nations leaders were implicated, including Namibians.
Mm.
One thing that was pointed out is that most of this money leaves host countries.
Mm.
It's taken outside the countries to other countries for investment purposes. And this is investment by proxy. So now you are into the, you are a local real estate individual. You are just, you participate in Namibia's real estate market. Now you have to compete with a seemingly humble looking guy that's coming out of the Middle East.
Yeah.
Who is also coming to participate in Namibia's real estate market. Now, you are looking at this guy, and he seems fairly, at your level in terms of, in terms of the business that you do. Except he has one heck of financial backing, because you are investing your own money. He's investing that money on behalf of the Saudi royal family. How am I supposed to compete with that?
Yep.
Short answer, you don't stand a chance. Now, the more guys like that will basically obviously show up in your market. They'll start buying, properties like loaves of bread. What will that do to the housing market? Check the prices up.
Yep.
Because, the very simple business idea, business phenomenon rather, is that the more demand will be, the more the cost will rise.
Mm.
And it's not like you can reduce the demand by telling them, we'll just sell it to you at a lower price. Then they will buy more, then they will buy more properties. So that means we need an alternative housing initiative that is thinking of housing, of solving the housing problem like Transient did to the smartphone market across the African continent, unfortunately. For us Africans, fortunately for Transient. And what they looked at is let's provide this amount of let's provide a house of this price to this market without first looking at can they afford it.
Yeah.
Because that's what Transient looked at.
Yeah.
Can they afford this smartphone? Can they afford a Samsung? No. Can they afford an iPhone? No. What can they afford? What's the average income earning in that environment? And can we build an electronic device that fits that income bracket? They did that.
Okay, they didn't even go that sophisticated, Helmut. You're making them now sound like they did some true economic analysis. All they did was let's improve on certain features of the product that the other companies have not taken into consideration when selling to Africans.
Yeah, because everyone was looking at, here is our product, this is the price.
Yeah, it's standardized.
You will have to afford it. You are not going to have any.
Yeah, across the world, it's the same price, the same product, it works the same. But yet, Africans will have to pay a little bit higher than, let's say, a guy from Brazil. So, yeah, you are right, to an extent. Sorry, Helmut, to an extent. Because the Transient guys just looked at, hey, let's just add in an AI feature that clears up the way in which the photo is taken when Africans are standing in darkness. I'm really sorry, guys, but that's an actual statement from the documentary Helmut and I watched. The guy did say that. They improved the flash function so that when you take a photo in the darkness and you're in a poor light, in a light deficient environment,
yeah,
then the flash or the AI image administration software helps to doctor the image for you. So yeah, you get a filter. I'm sorry for those guys who don't like filters, but yeah, you get a filter.
Oh,
just so that the image comes out a little bit more better. And That's basically what the Transion guys did. Or Transion, I think. That's the name. Yeah, Transion. And the funny thing is, the products are completely only geared towards Africa. It's not even geared towards global rollout. It's for the whole of Africa. So, yeah, we have this interesting thing that obviously, is taking place there. We'll quickly take a short break, dear listeners. After the break, we'll come back, say our potential goodbyes, since we've also sort of like, glided into the BES time slot. But there's actually something that is lined up in terms of a live stream, that is expected to happen or come about in the next few minutes. Stay tuned. We'll be back after the short break.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. Mm. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past. Mm. And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM.
Lipurane ngeno wapumbwa Eva Tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kutite opoye ekukurile oshafa fana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwala konongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa nune udo otukwetira o special angeta shake ngeshefa omarudi kayo loka opone ushendi fenawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa Ninge pata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM onora tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile ko berewa bra hetatu natu bali o hetatu matatu o mafelane Eagle FM the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Lipurane ngeno wapumbwa Eva Tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kutite opoye ekukurile oshafa fana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwala konongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa nune udo otukwetira o special angeta shake ngeshefa omarudi kayo loka opone ushendi fenawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa ninge pata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM onora etatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile ko berewa bra hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu o mafelane Eagle FM the eye.
Welcome back. So, for me, it on this whole Africa, you know, housing problem that we would like to solve. We have been trying since the 1980s.
Yeah, Namibia has been trying since, was it 2018, 2013? No, 2010 with mass housing. Look where that got us. Look where that got.
Okay, first of all, the $1.4 trillion should have been edited to feature, you know, to accommodate the current global atmosphere. because, oh, it's going to change a lot. Take agriculture alone, because of the whole fertilizer situation, is going to be impacted. That means agriculture practice on a commercial level, you now have to, if your main supply of fertilizer has been coming out of the Middle East, you need to find a new supplier.
Yep.
Because, well, here's the, one thing about crops is that, you know, crops have, they're very strict to seasons. You can't have maize during winter.
You technically can if you're in Namibia. Our winter.
During winter.
How much, you know, your region most actually doesn't get winter.
It does.
Which one? East or west?
East.
East. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. On a hypothetical scenario, yes, let's go with that particular scenario, but there is another crop you can grow that would be resilient to the conditions that you find in Kavango East.
Yeah, but, okay, take for example, if you are a commercial farmer that's been, you know, who's main, okay, you've been getting your fertilizer from South Africa because, well, we buy most of the stuff from South Africa, but their main supplier has been supplying, you know, their main supplier is based in the Middle East. That's where the manufacturer of that particular fertilizer is.
Mm.
Because of the whole, you know, political and economic chaos, political that's leading up to economic chaos coming out of the Middle East, you will obviously see significant increase in, in fertilizer prices.
Mm.
And what are all businesses based on? Return on investment.
Yep.
If your fertilizer is costing more than your, the profit you made last year in terms of returns, you start thinking twice about what's the point of even continuing this business?
Yep.
Except, well, there are people, unfortunately, and this is something I just discovered, I mean, discovered recently. Because of that Israeli journalist who, you know, people were looking for, because he decided to make a video of a bomb falling on a pad that people have spent millions of dollars betting that the bomb is not going to fall on that particular location. So people are not now betting on the war.
Yeah, I found it out last year as well. It was pretty sad. And people are making money.
Yeah. Millions. And that poor journalist now was running for his life. What did I do?
Oh, the guy that reported that the bomb. I remember that story.
Like, look, I was just doing my job.
I remember that guy. And the people were like, why did you announce the bomb failure? The guy was just doing his job.
Yeah.
Yeah. But before that, guys, it does bring us up to the end for our discussion this evening. We are crossing over to a live stream coming through from one of the Eagle FM client streamers or streaming sessions, which is a live broadcast by the – just want to get the name here, guys, because the name in itself is a little bit unclear.
Agripreneurial Innovation Challenge official launch, which is now taking place, which is basically showcasing everything from marketing and now obviously, as you can tell, agripreneurial, that's a combination of agriculture and entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
We're never leaving agriculture alone, are we?
Helmut, what is one of the Urbanization Forum's goals? Modernization, but the unfortunate thing is we keep jumping back to agriculture. But on that note, guys, we've got a crossover. Stay tuned and enjoy the live broadcast coming through right now. We'll see each other again, same time, same place tomorrow.
Yeah.